Chapter 9. The White Man's Burden. Take up the white man's burden, the savage wars of peace. Fill full the mouth of famine, and bid the sickness cease. Rudyard Kipling, The White Man's Burden, 1897. In 1984, following Dr. Robert Gallo's notorious press conference, Dr. Fauci promised the world an AIDS vaccine forthwith. Delivering a functioning AIDS immunization would, of course, be the most persuasive debunking of the Duisbergians and other critics of the HIV-AIDS hypothesis. Finally, Dr. Fauci assured the global press, "Given the fact that we now have the virus in our hands, it is quite possible, in fact, it's inevitable that we will develop a vaccine for AIDS." Margaret Heckler told the media scrum, "We hope to have a vaccine ready for testing in about 2 years." Heckler was off the mark by a third of a century and counting. In the intervening decades, the federal government spent well over half of $1 trillion on AIDS. Dr. Fauci has dedicated much of that moolah to his quest for an elusive vaccine to immunize people against HIV. Dr. Fauci pumped our money into nearly 100 vaccine candidates, with none of these coming even close to the finish line. All these disappointments never darkened Dr. Fauci's buoyant optimism that he will soon collar that retreating horizon. For a decade, Oklahoma's U.S. Senator Tom Coburn, M.D., occupied front row seats in congressional and Senate health committees during Dr. Fauci's annual gallivants to Capitol Hill. By 2010, Coburn had wearied at the NIAID director's bootless promises of the imminent delivery of his quixotic jab. When on May 18th, Dr. Fauci returned to the Senate hearing room to tout significant progress in HIV vaccine research, the normally taciturn Dr. Coburn finally exploded. He lambasted Dr. Fauci for deliberately deceiving lawmakers and accused his fellow physician of hoodwinking Congress into approving appropriations with no purpose beyond sustaining his bureaucracy. Most scientists involved in AIDS research believe that an HIV vaccine is further away than ever, he said. It had taken years of Dr. Fauci's ritualistic pilgrimages for Coburn to recognize with indignant clarity that attempted HIV vaccines are an ATM for NIH, whether they work or not. From an institutional standpoint, none of Dr. Fauci's failed experiments were, after all, failures. They each resulted in massive transfers of public lucre to Dr. Fauci's pharma partners and sustaining funding for NIAID's laboratories and PIs. The only true failure at NIAID would be a shrinking workforce. This verity remains utterly obscure to the dewy-eyed press, which faithfully applauds each of Dr. Fauci's Groundhog Day encores. In 2019, nearly a decade after Coburn's remonstrance, and only a few months before the COVID-19 pandemic, Dr. Fauci made a surprise announcement. He finally had a working HIV vaccine. While the inoculation had demonstrated a bare-bones 30% efficacy in human trials in Thailand, data from the Phase 3 trial in South Africa looked promising, and NIAID was getting teed up to test the vaccine on Americans. Dr. Fauci added some deflating caveats. While his new vaccine didn't prevent transmission of AIDS, the nimble technocrat jauntily predicted that intrepid souls who took the jab would find that when they did get AIDS, the symptoms would seem to be much reduced. So confident was Dr. Fauci of the media's slavish credulity that he assumed correctly that he'd never need to answer the many questions raised by this feverish gibberish. That entire odd proposition received zero critical press commentary. His success at slapping lipstick on this donkey and selling it to the world as a thoroughbred may have emboldened his ruse a year later of placing similar cosmetics on the COVID vaccines that likewise neither prevent disease nor preclude transmission. A parade of horribles. The 30-year decampment of journalistic scrutiny means that there is still no coherent public narrative chronicling Dr. Fauci's futile quest for his inevitable AIDS vaccine, much less accountability. Industry and government scientists have instead shrouded the scandalous saga in secrecy, subterfuge, and prevarication, obscuring a thousand calamities and a sea of tears deserving its own book. Every meager effort to research the debacle on Google, PubMed, news sites, and published clinical trial data yields only shocking new atrocities, a grim, repetitive parade of horribles, heartbreaking tragedies, entrenched institutional arrogance and racism, broken promises, vast expenditures of squandered treasure, and the recurring chicanery of Anthony Fauci, Bob Gallo, and Bill Gates. It's a darker version of Groundhog Day, devoid of humor, irony, wisdom, or redemption. It will be an easier read if I touch on only a few random lowlights of the painful saga. Gallo Redux. In 1991, as part of a settlement ending years of litigation, Bob Gallo finally admitted that he had stolen the HIV virus from Montagnier. He was hardly chastened. On April 14th, John Crutzen reported in the Chicago Tribune that one of Gallo's experiments with an HIV vaccine had killed three AIDS patients in Paris the previous year. NIH had launched the project before handing it off to Gallo and his trusty henchman, Daniel Zaghouri, who tested the concoction on volunteers in France and, predictably, an African country, this time Zaire. His cronies at the National Cancer Institute had granted Gallo's experiments expedited review approval. How expedited? Just 25 days. The patients died after Gallo's team inoculated them with an HIV vaccine derived from cowpox. NIH scientists formulated the preparation from vaccinia, a virus that causes cowpox in bovines, into which the government scientists genetically inserted a fragment of the HIV virus. Apparently, the cowpox remained infectious, and three of their 19 Paris volunteers immediately developed vaccinia, a frequently fatal necrosis, which caused acute lesions and an expanse of hardened, swollen, purplish-red skin around the victims' injection sites as the disease devoured their flesh. As is typical of AIDS vaccine research, the NIH scientists cached the atrocity. Neither Gallo nor Zaghouri reported the deaths. Instead, Gallo vaunted the trial as a great success in the Lancet's July 21, 1990 edition, audaciously claiming that there had been no deaths and no complications or discomfort among any of those to whom he administered the preparation. One of Dr. Gallo's casualties was a 42-year-old classic literature professor, regarded as a brilliant Egyptologist, who succumbed March 5, 1990, more than 4 months before Gallo's article appeared. A second volunteer, a 36-year-old Paris University librarian, died on July 6th, weeks before Gallo published his article. Friends described Gallo's two victims as healthy and vibrant in the days and weeks immediately preceding their deaths. It was unimaginable, a co-worker said of the robust professor, that he could have died 6 weeks later. A longtime friend of Dr. Gallo's third victim, who died on October 1, 1990, asked Zaghouri's principal assistant, Dr. Odile Picard, whether the experimental vaccine may have caused the destructive lesions that the coroner detected on the victim's brain during autopsy. Picard assured him the vaccines were not at fault, adding, "We don't know what this is." A month after this conversation, Picard delivered another paper, also signed by Gallo and Zaghouri, at an international AIDS meeting in Paris, the Colloque des Sans Garde. Here again, Picard mentioned nothing about the three deaths, telling her colleagues that the vaccinia preparation had shown itself safe in patients. Perhaps she meant safe for those patients who survived. André Bouet, the distinguished French geneticist and secretary to France's National Committee on Medical Ethics, who approved the vaccine trials in 1987, complained that Gallo never informed his panel that any of the subjects had died. Officials of Assistance Publique, the municipal hospital system in Paris, grumbled that Gallo's team also neglected to tell them of the three fatalities. French officials only learned of the deaths from physicians who became suspicious at hospitals where Gallo's team had shipped their ailing recruits to die. NIH managers also protested that Gallo had not come clean about the deaths. One functionary called Gallo's omission very troubling. NIH records show that neither Gallo nor any of his NIH confederates informed the Office of Protection from Research Risks about the body count. Federal law requires that OPRR approve human experimentation and that researchers report adverse events, including, of course, the most adverse event. In February, citing multiple violations of federal regulations by Gallo and his team on both sides of the Atlantic, the OPRR abruptly halted the experiment. Channeling his mentor's hallmark chutzpah, Zaghouri, after submitting the Chipper Lancet article, applied for a patent on the deadly vaccine technology called Methods of Inducing Immune Responses to the AIDS Virus, with Zaghouri listing himself as an inventor in the application. Once again, the omerta held. There was no investigation, no accountability, and no word of what sort of injuries the volunteers in the Zaire arm of the study may have suffered. Characteristically, Gallo was unembarrassed, unbowed, and undaunted by this latest setback. The bought and bullied virology community stayed silent about a scandal that would have implicated NIH and provoked unwanted scrutiny of the HIV orthodoxies. 5 years later, Gallo left NCI and established the Institute for Human Virology, IHV, with his two longtime cronies, William Blattner, who served for 22 years under Gallo as director of viral epidemiology at NCI, and Robert Redfield, a military doctor and researcher who shared Gallo's lifelong obsession with HIV and his ethical lacunae. Dr. Robert Redfield. Many Americans will recognize Redfield as Donald Trump's CDC director during the 2020 COVID pandemic. Dr. Redfield and his faithful sidekick, Dr. Deborah Birx, served with Dr. Fauci on Trump's coronavirus task force. Both Redfield and Birx were former Army medical officers who, in the 1980s and 1990s, led the military's AIDS research, a specialty that seems like a magnet for hucksters and quacks. U.S. military documents show that in 1992, Redfield and Birx, his then assistant, both serving at Walter Reed in Washington, published inaccurate data in the New England Journal of Medicine, claiming that an HIV vaccine they helped develop and tested on Walter Reed patients was effective. They both must have known the vaccine was worthless. In 1992, an Air Force medical office accused Redfield of engaging in a systematic pattern of data manipulation, inappropriate statistical analyses, and misleading data presentation in an apparent attempt to promote the usefulness of the GP160 AIDS vaccine. A specially convened Air Force tribunal on scientific fraud and misconduct concluded that Redfield's misleading or possibly deceptive information seriously threatens his credibility as a researcher and has the potential to negatively impact AIDS research funding for military institutions as a whole. His allegedly unethical behavior creates false hope and could result in premature deployment of the vaccine. The tribunal recommended investigation by a fully independent outside investigative body. Under threat of court-martial, loss of his medical license, and possible imprisonment, Dr. Redfield confessed to angry DOD interrogators and to the tribunal that his analyses were faulty and deceptive. He agreed to correct them and to publicly admit the vaccine was worthless at an upcoming AIDS conference at which he was scheduled to speak in July 1992. Perhaps it was the grandeur of the hall, the microphone, and the audience that conspired to weaken his resolve. Instead of retracting his falsehood, he boldly repeated his fraudulent claims at this and two subsequent international HIV conferences. As astonished prosecutors watched, he then brazenly parroted his debunked perjuries in testimony before Congress, swearing that his vaccine cured HIV. Redfield's bold gambit worked. Bamboozled by Redfield's brazen ballyhoo, Congress immediately appropriated $20 million to the military to support Redfield and Birx's research project. Enraged military prosecutors wanted to court-martial Redfield. But as Public Citizen complained in a 1994 letter to the Congressional Committee's chairman, Henry Waxman, the dedicated budget hikes promised by Congress prompted the Army to kill the investigation, silence its own prosecutors, and whitewash Redfield's misdeeds. By snatching triumph from the jaws of career-ending disaster, Redfield had pulled off the perfect crime. The bold flim-flam catapulted Birx and Redfield into their stellar careers as top federal health officials. Whatever other lessons he learned from the episode, recklessness and mendacity continued to be Redfield's go-to strategies. Gallo's partnership with Redfield became a gold mine for both men. Dr. Gallo told me in a May 11, 2021 email that the Institute of Human Virology's annual budget, the IHV, is in excess of $100 million. A majority of this funding is from PEPFAR. President George W. Bush created PEPFAR in 2003 at Dr. Fauci's urging to coordinate AIDS assistance from all the various federal government, civilian, and military sources. Since 2014, PEPFAR's administrator has been Deborah Birx, who simultaneously served on the board of the Bill Gates-backed Global Fund. In 2017, the IHV's annual report boasted that these two quacksalvers had won over $600 million in grants, much of it from NIH and Bill Gates, since they cemented their lucrative partnership. They seem to have spent the bulk of that loot experimenting with failed HIV drugs and vaccines on black people, including 20,000 residents of Washington and Baltimore, and 1.3 million misfortunates from Africa and the Caribbean. Gallo and Redfield's IHV partnership was a good bet. They had an academic affiliation with the University of Maryland, their own nonprofit to launder grant money from their old NIH, NIAID, and NCI cronies, and a for-profit spin-off that would allow them to monetize their taxpayer-funded discoveries. Their former accomplices at NIH were pumping $200 million annually into the HIV vaccine boondoggle. Moreover, Redfield had an inside track through Birx and through his military confederates to the vast Pentagon budgets for bioweapons and infectious disease. Those connections yielded plenty of federal dough to keep everyone in the chips. Furthermore, in 1998, a new HIV funder appeared, one with deep pockets and a shared obsession with vaccines. That year, the William H. Gates Foundation announced a 9-year, $500 million plan to fund AIDS vaccine development through Gates's International AIDS Vaccine Initiative, IAVI, the predecessor organization to the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunizations, GAVI. IAVI's president, Seth Berkley, Gates's faithful and extravagantly compensated minion, said the plan would fund multiple efficacy trials of AIDS vaccine candidates in developing countries. If any of the vaccines worked even reasonably well on sub-Saharan Africans, they could then presumably be tested in Western countries. Despite Redfield's well-publicized history as a charlatan and pretender, President Donald Trump put him in charge of the CDC at a time when the agency's overarching mission was promoting COVID vaccines. Trump also elevated Birx, a lifelong protege to both Redfield and Anthony Fauci, and confidant to Bill Gates. These three vaccine mountebanks, Redfield, Birx, and Fauci, led the White House Coronavirus Task Force and steered America's COVID response during the first year of the pandemic. The trio, none of whom ever treated a COVID patient, adopted controversial strategies to confine the nation under house arrest, shut down the global economy, deny the public access to early treatment and life-saving therapeutics like hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, excite persistent public terror through the broadcasts of deliberately exaggerated death and case counts, and repeatedly tell the world that the only path back to normal is a miraculous vaccine. With minimal scientific support, they imposed draconian quarantine, mask, and social distancing mandates, purposefully or accidentally inducing a species of mass psychosis called Stockholm Syndrome, wherein hostages become grateful to their captors, convinced that the only path to survival is unquestioning obedience. The Gates-Fauci bromance. 2 years after Gates announced IAVI, he summoned Dr. Fauci to Seattle to propose a partnership that, 2 decades later, would have profound impacts on humanity. Dr. Fauci first met Bill and Melinda Gates during that Seattle trip, ostensibly for a conversation about combating tuberculosis. The Microsoft billionaire had invited the NIAID chief to a muster of global health honchos at his 40,000-square-foot, $127 million mansion rising from 40 wooded acres on the banks of Lake Washington. After dinner, Gates culled Fauci from the herd and corralled him into his spectacular blue-domed library overlooking the lake. Fauci remembered, Melinda was showing everyone on a tour of the house, and he said, "Can I have some time with you in my library, this amazingly beautiful library?" And we sat down, and it was there that he said, "Tony, you run the biggest infectious disease institute of the world, and I want to be sure the money I spend is well spent. Why don't we really get to know each other? Why don't we be partners?" Over the next 2 decades, that partnership would metastasize to include pharmaceutical companies, military and intelligence planners, and international health agencies, all collaborating to promote weaponized pandemics and vaccines, and a new brand of corporate imperialism rooted in the ideology of biosecurity. That project would yield Mr. Gates and Dr. Fauci unprecedented bonanzas in wealth and power and have catastrophic consequences for democracy and humanity. The Microsoft monopoly. Influence peddling fueled Bill Gates's drive to power from the outset. Gates came from a wealthy family. His great-grandfather made a fortune in banking and left Bill a trust fund worth millions in today's dollars. After dropping out of Harvard in 1975, Gates leveraged his passion for software engineering to launch Microsoft in an era when most Americans still used typewriters. At the time, his mother, Mary Gates, a prominent Seattle businesswoman, sat on the United Way board alongside then-IBM chairman John Opel. In 1980, IBM was looking to recruit a software concern to develop an operating system for its personal computer. Mary Gates persuaded Opel to take a chance on her son. That intervention propelled Gates's fledgling firm into the big leagues and made Gates a billionaire within 2 decades. Gates's closest boyhood friend, and the Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen described Gates in his 2011 book, Idea Man, a Memoir, as a sarcastic bully who in 1982 schemed to oust him and steal his share of their company. Back at work following a bout with cancer, an anemic Allen, depleted by radiation and chemotherapy, overheard Gates conniving with Microsoft's new manager Steve Ballmer to dilute Allen's stake. Allen recalled bursting in and shouting, "This is unbelievable. It shows your true character once and for all." Declining Gates' $5 a share buyout offer, Allen left Microsoft with his 25% stake intact, becoming a billionaire when the company went public in 1986. In May 1998, the Department of Justice and 20 state attorneys general filed antitrust charges against Microsoft, accusing Gates' company of illegally thwarting efforts by consumers to install competing software on its Windows-based computers. The DOJ asked the federal trial court in Seattle to fine Gates a record $1 million a day for antitrust violations. Judge Thomas Penfield Jackson ruled that Microsoft had violated the 1890 Sherman Antitrust Act prohibitions outlawing monopolies and cartels, saying Microsoft placed an oppressive thumb on the scale of competitive fortune, thereby effectively guaranteeing its continued dominance in the relevant market. Judge Jackson ordered Microsoft to divide itself in halves and divest either its operating system or its software arm. An appeals court overturned that decision. In a settlement, the DOJ abandoned its drive to break up the company, and Microsoft agreed to pay an anemic $800,000 fine and to share computing interfaces with competing firms. Aside from the financial cost, the litigation had blighted Gates's reputation. Judge Jackson complained that Gates's testimony was evasive and forgetful, and observed that he has a Napoleonic concept of himself and his company, an arrogance that derives from power and unalloyed success, with no leavening hard experience, no reverses. The public had seen enough of the trial and of Gates's revealing depositions to share Judge Jackson's revulsion. An online group called SPOGGE gained widespread popularity. The acronym stands for Society for Preventing Gates from Getting Everything. Class action lawsuits filed in 2000 against the company for gross discrimination against African-American workers and for including racially charged messages in its software further blighted Gates's pockmarked public image. Legendary plaintiff's lawyer Willie Gary complained that Microsoft had a plantation mentality when it comes to treating African-American workers, and observed that there are glass ceilings and walls for African-American workers at Microsoft. Gary settled the case for $97 million. 2 years later, European regulators levied a $1.36 billion fine against Microsoft, the highest penalty in EU history. Gates reacted to snowballing popular disgust by lobbying Congress to slash the Justice Department's budget and by hiring an army of PR firms to soften his image as a ruthless and duplicitous King Baby robber baron. As part of a concerted offensive to recast his public persona, Gates and his wife formed a charity, the Children's Vaccine Program, with an impressive $100 million donation. The Rockefeller-Gates Nexus. A century earlier, America's first billionaire, John D. Rockefeller, had blazed his own wildly successful exit ramp from public loathing, bad press, and antitrust prosecution by launching a medical philanthropy. John D. Rockefeller's consigliere, Frederick Taylor Gates, served as John D.'s chief business confidant and philanthropic advisor. Frederick Gates helped Rockefeller structure his foundation, advising the mogul that judicious disposal of his fortune might also blunt further inquiry into its origins. Practically from his nativity, Bill Gates began coordinating his own foundation's giving with the Rockefeller Organization. In 2018, Bill Gates made the salient observation that everywhere our foundation went, we discovered the Rockefeller Foundation had been there first. At the 20th century's dawn, Rockefeller's sanguinary maneuvering, including bribery, price fixing, corporate espionage, and creating shell companies to conduct illegal activities, had won his Standard Oil Company control of 90% of U.S. oil production and made him the richest man in world history, with a net worth of over $500 billion in today's dollars. Senator Robert Lafayette excoriated Rockefeller as the greatest criminal of the age. The oil magnate's father, William Devil Bill Rockefeller, was a marauding con artist who supported his family by posing as a doctor and hawking snake oil, opium elixirs, patent medicines, and other miracle cures. In the early 1900s, as scientists discovered pharmaceutical uses for refinery byproducts, John D. saw an opportunity to capitalize on the family's medical pedigree. At that time, nearly half the physicians and medical colleges in the United States practiced holistic or herbal medicine. Rockefeller and his friend Andrew Carnegie, the Big Steel robber baron, dispatched educator Abraham Flexner on a cross-country tour to catalog the status of America's 155 medical colleges and hospitals. The Rockefeller Foundation's 1910 Flexner Report recommended centralizing America's medical schooling, abolishing miasma theory, and reorienting these institutions according to germ theory, which held that germs alone caused disease, and the pharmaceutical paradigm that emphasized targeting particular germs with specific drugs rather than fortifying the immune system through healthy living, clean water, and good nutrition. With that narrative in hand, Rockefeller financed the campaign to consolidate mainstream medicine, co-opt the burgeoning pharmaceutical industry, and shutter its competition. Rockefeller's crusade caused the closure of more than half of American medical schools, fostered public and press scorn for homeopathy, osteopathy, chiropractic, nutritional, holistic, functional, integrative, and natural medicines, and led to the incarceration of many practicing physicians. Miasma versus germ theory. Miasma theory emphasizes preventing disease by fortifying the immune system through nutrition and by reducing exposures to environmental toxins and stresses. Miasma exponents posit that disease occurs where a weakened immune system provides germs an enfeebled target to exploit. They analogize the human immune system to the skin of an apple. With the skin intact, the fruit will last a week at room temperature and a month if refrigerated. But even a small injury to the skin triggers systemic rot within hours as the billions of opportunistic microbes thronging on the skin of every living organism colonize the injured terrain. Germ theory aficionados, in contrast, blame disease on microscopic pathogens. Their approach to health is to identify the culpable germ and tailor a poison to kill it. Miasmists complain that those patented poisons may themselves further weaken the immune system or simply open the damaged terrain to a competitive germ or cause chronic disease. They point out that the world is teeming with microbes, many of them beneficial, and nearly all of them harmless to a healthy, well-nourished immune system. Miasmists argue that malnutrition and inadequate access to clean water are the ultimate stressors that make infectious diseases lethal in impoverished locales. When a starving African child succumbs to measles, the miasmist attributes the death to malnutrition. Germ theory proponents, aka virologists, blame the virus. The miasmist approach to public health is to boost individual immune response. For better or worse, the champions of germ theory, Louis Pasteur and Robert Koch, proved victorious in their fierce decades-long battle with their miasmist rival, Antoine Béchamp. Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Will Durant suggests that germ theory found popular purchase by mimicking the traditional explanation for disease, demon possession, giving it a leg up over miasma. The ubiquity of pasteurization and vaccinations are only two of the many indicators of the domineering ascendancy of germ theory as the cornerstone of contemporary public health policy. A $1 trillion pharmaceutical industry pushing patented pills, powders, pricks, potions, and poisons, and the powerful professions of virology and vaccinology led by little Napoleon himself, Anthony Fauci, fortifies the century-old predominance of germ theory. And so, with the microbe theory, the cornerstone was laid for modern biomedicine's basic formula, with its monocausal microbial starting point and its search for magic bullets. One disease, one cause, one cure, writes American sociology professor Stephen Epstein. As Dr. Klaus Kuhnlein and Torsten Engelbrecht observe in Virus Mania, the idea that certain microbes, above all fungi, bacteria, and viruses, are our great opponents in battle, causing certain diseases that must be fought with special chemical bombs, has buried itself deep into the collective conscience. Imperialist ideologues find natural affinity with germ theory. A war on germs rationalizes a militarized approach to public health and endless intervention in poor nations that bear heavy disease burdens. And just as the military-industrial complex prospers in war, the pharmaceutical cartel profits most from sick and malnourished populations. On his deathbed, the victorious Pasteur is said to have recanted, "Béchamp was right," declaring, "The microbe is nothing, the terrain is everything." Miasma theory survives in marginalized yet vibrant pockets among integrative and functional medicine practitioners. And burgeoning science, documenting the critical role of the microbiome in human health and immunity, tends to vindicate Béchamp, and particularly his teachings that microorganisms are beneficial to good health. Kuhnlein and Engelbrecht observe that, but even for mainstream medicine, it is becoming increasingly clear that the biological terrain of our intestines, the intestinal flora, teeming with bacteria, or weighing up to a kilogram in a normal adult human totaling 100 trillion cells, is accorded a decisive role because it is by far the body's biggest and most important immune system. A doctrinal canon of the germ theory credits vaccines for the dramatic declines of infectious disease mortalities in North America and Europe during the 20th century. Anthony Fauci, for example, routinely proclaims that vaccines eliminated mortalities from the infectious diseases of the early 20th century, saving millions of lives. On July 4, 2021, he commented to NBC's Chuck Todd, "You know, as the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, it was my responsibility to make sure that we did the science that got us to the vaccines that, as we know now, have already saved millions and millions of lives." Most Americans accept this claim as dogma. It will therefore come as a surprise to learn that it is simply untrue. Science actually gives the honor of having vanquished infectious disease mortalities to nutrition and sanitation. A comprehensive study of this foundational assertion, published in 2000 in the high gravitas journal Pediatrics by CDC and Johns Hopkins scientists, concluded, after reviewing a century of medical data, that vaccination does not account for the impressive decline in mortality from infectious diseases in the 20th century. As noted earlier, another widely cited study, McKinley and McKinley, required reading in virtually every American medical school during the 1970s, found that all medical interventions, including vaccines, surgeries, and antibiotics, accounted for less than about 1% and no more than 3.5% of the dramatic mortality declines. The McKinleys presciently warned that profiteers among the medical establishment would seek to claim credit for the mortality declines for vaccines in order to justify government mandates for those pharmaceutical products. 7 years earlier, the world's foremost virologist, Harvard Medical School's Dr. Edward H. Cass, a founding member and first president of the Infectious Diseases Society of America and founding editor of the Journal of Infectious Diseases, rebuked his virology colleagues for trying to take credit for that dramatic decline, scolding them for allowing the proliferation of half-truths that medical research had stamped out the great killers of the past, tuberculosis, diphtheria, pneumonia, puerperal sepsis, etc., and that medical research and our superior system of medical care were major factors extending life expectancy. Cass recognized that the real heroes of public health were not the medical profession, but rather the engineers who brought us sewage treatment plants, railroads, roads, and highways for transporting food, electric refrigerators, and chlorinated water. I refer you to the Children's Health Defense website for graphs that demonstrate mortalities for virtually all the great killer diseases, infectious and otherwise, declined with advances in nutrition and sanitation. The most dramatic declines occurred prior to vaccine introduction. These graphs pose an indomitable challenge to germ theory's central dogma and stark support for miasma's approach to medicine. Note the mortality declines occurred in both infectious and non-infectious diseases, irrespective of the availability of vaccines. When the tide is receding from the beach, it is easy to have the illusion that one can empty the ocean by removing the water with a pail. René Dubos. As doctors Engelbrecht and Kuhnlein observe, epidemics rarely occur in affluent societies because these societies offer conditions, sufficient nutrition, clean drinking water, etc., which allow many people to keep their immune systems so fit that microbes simply do not have a chance to multiply abnormally. As a final side note, it seems to me that a mutually respectful science-based, evidence-based marriage incorporating the best of these two clashing dogmas would best serve public health and humankind. Fauci and Gates, Germ Theory as Foreign Policy. The arcane conflict between germ and miasma theorists has important resonance for public health policy in the developing world, where many policy advocates fiercely protest that a dollar spent on food and clean water is far more effective than a dollar spent on vaccines. As we shall see, the Gates-Fauci militarized approach to medicine has precipitated an apocalyptic battle on the African and Asian continents between the two philosophies in a zero-sum game that pits nutrition and sanitation against vaccines in a life-and-death conflict for resources and legitimacy. The historic clash between these warring philosophies offers a useful framework for understanding Bill Gates and Anthony Fauci's approach to public health. In order to assess the effectiveness of their mass vaccination projects, we would need a disciplined accounting that compares health outcomes in vaccinated populations to similarly situated unvaccinated cohorts. This is the kind of accounting that neither of these men has been willing to provide. The facts suggest that it is the absence of such reliable metrics and science-based analysis that allows Gates and Fauci to get away with their dubious claims about the efficacy and safety of their prescriptions. Any even-handed examination of the role of immunizations in Africa must acknowledge that mass vaccination programs may serve a larger agenda in which the priorities of power, wealth, and control can eclipse quaint preoccupations with public health. And once again, It was the Rockefeller Foundation that pioneered germ theory as a foreign policy tool. The triumph of germ theory. In 1911, the Supreme Court ruled that Standard Oil constituted an unreasonable monopoly and splintered the behemoth into 34 companies that became Exxon, Mobil, Chevron, Amoco, Marathon, and others. Ironically, the breakup increased rather than diminished Rockefeller's personal wealth. Rockefeller donated an additional $100 million from that windfall to his philanthropic front group, the General Education Board, to cement the streamlining and homogenization of medical schools and hospitals. In accordance with the pharmaceutical paradigm, he simultaneously provided large grants to scientists for identifying the active chemicals in disease-curing plants utilized by the traditional doctors whom he had extirpated. Rockefeller chemists then synthesized and patented petrochemical versions of those molecules. The Foundation's philosophy of a pill for an ill shaped how Americans came to view healthcare. In 1913, the Patriarch founded the American Cancer Society and incorporated the Rockefeller Foundation. Philanthropic foundations were an innovation of the era, and detractors criticized as tax evasion Rockefeller's scheme to take a $56 million deduction on his donation of 72,569 shares of Standard Oil to launch a foundation that would give him perpetual control of that donated wealth. A congressional investigation described the foundation as a self-serving artifice posing a menace to the future political and economic welfare of the nation. Congress repeatedly denied Rockefeller a charter. Attorney General George Wickersham denounced the foundation as a scheme for perpetuating vast wealth and entirely inconsistent with the public interest. To reassure public, politicians, and press of its benign purposes, the Rockefeller Foundation declared its ambition to eliminate hookworm, malaria, and yellow fever. The Rockefeller Sanitary Commission for the Eradication of Hookworm Disease sent teams of doctors, inspectors, and lab technicians to administer deworming medication across 11 southern states. These ambassadors systematically exaggerated the medication's efficacy, glossed over its regular fatalities, and through the graces of Rockefeller's mercenary army of journalists for hire, ignited enough favorable popular interest for the foundation to justify the proposed expansion into the colonized world. The Rockefeller Foundation launched a public-private partnership with pharmaceutical companies called the International Health Commission, which set about feverishly inoculating the hapless populations of the colonized tropics with a yellow fever jab. The vaccine killed its beneficiaries in droves and failed to prevent yellow fever. The Rockefeller Foundation quietly dropped the useless vaccine after the foundation's star researcher, the yellow fever vaccine's inventor, Hideo Noguchi, succumbed to the disease, likely contracted through careless laboratory exposure. Noguchi's flexible scruples had greased his dicey experimentation on colonized volunteers and fueled his meteoric rise in the ethically barren landscapes of virology. At the time of his death, the New York District Attorney was investigating Noguchi for illegally experimenting on New York City orphans with syphilis vaccines without the consent of their legal guardians. Despite such setbacks, the Rockefeller Foundation's Yellow Fever Project caught the approbatory attention of army planners on the lookout for remedies against the tropical diseases that hamstrung the U.S. military's expanding retinue of equatorial adventures. In 1916, the board's president made an early observation about the utility of biosecurity as a tool of imperialism. For purposes of placating primitive and suspicious peoples, medicine has some advantages over machine guns. The Rockefeller Foundation's carefully heralded public health attainments eclipsed popular revulsion for the many abuses Americans associated with the Standard Oil Petroleum Empire. After World War I, its patronage of the League of Nations Health Organization gave the Rockefeller Foundation global reach and an impressive cortege of high-level contacts among the international elites. As the century progressed, the foundation became an exquisitely connected global enterprise with regional offices in Mexico City, Paris, New Delhi, and Cali. From 1913 to 1951, the Rockefeller Foundation's health division operated in more than 80 countries. The Rockefeller Foundation was the world's de facto authority on how best to manage global diseases, with influence dwarfing all other nonprofits or government actors working in the field. The Rockefeller Foundation provided almost half of the budget for the League of Nations Health Organization, LNHO, following its founding in 1922, and populated LNHO ranks with its veterans and favorites. The RF imbued the League with its philosophy, structure, values, precepts, and ideologies, all of which its successor body, the WHO, inherited at its inauguration in 1948. By the time John D. Rockefeller disbanded the Rockefeller Foundation's International Health Division in 1951, it had spent the equivalent of billions of dollars on tropical disease campaigns in almost 100 countries and colonies. But these projects were window dressing for the Foundation's more venal preoccupations, according to a 2017 report, U.S. Philanthrocapitalism and the Global Health Agenda. That E-Day fix was opening developing world markets for U.S. oil, mining, pharmaceutical, telecom, and banking multinationals in which the Foundation and the Rockefeller family were also invested. That white paper made the same complaints against the Rockefeller Foundation that contemporary critics level against the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. But the Rockefeller Foundation rarely addressed the most important causes of death, notably infantile diarrhea and tuberculosis, for which technical fixes were not then available and which demanded long-term, socially-oriented investments such as improved housing, clean water, and sanitation systems. The RF avoided disease campaigns that might be costly, complex, or time-consuming, other than yellow fever, which imperiled the military and commerce. Most campaigns were narrowly construed so that quantifiable targets, insecticide spraying or medication distribution, for example, could be set, met, and counted as successes, then presented in business-style quarterly reports. In the process, RF public health efforts stimulated economic productivity, expanded consumer markets, and prepared vast regions for foreign investment and incorporation into the expanding system of global capitalism. Here was a business model tailor-made for Bill Gates.